IT transformation calls for true collaboration between cross-functional teams, from leaders to developers. Stop reacting to change and start leading transformation. Visit BoozAllen.com/Federal News Radio.
Back on the Federal Drive with Tom Temin on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu, filling in for Tom. For decades, the U.S. government has taken pains to help other countries account for their nuclear materials and to make sure they're safe and secure. But within the United States, there are dozens of pounds of weapons-grade uranium and plutonium that are totally unaccounted for. It's roughly enough to make 5 functioning nuclear warheads. And that's just the quantity we know about, because the Department of Energy doesn't discuss nuclear material that's been lost or stolen. And it appears to have relatively few accountability measures in place to deal with problems when they happen. Those are some of the findings of a new report published by the Center for Public Integrity. Patrick Malone is an investigative reporter at the center. He talked with me about the problem of what the government refers to as material unaccounted for.
Material unaccounted for is nuclear material, specifically from the, as it's used in the Department of Energy and military parlance, is nuclear material that could be used for weapons that is unaccounted for. Its whereabouts are unknown. Could be anywhere. Could be in anyone's possession.
Could be lost, or it could be just stuck in the production process from decades ago. We really don't know, right?
That's correct. There has been a fair amount of nuclear material recovered whenever there's a job that sort of replaces, for instance, the duct work at some of the national labs. They'll find bits that are trapped in there. They'll find it in what is called glove boxes, which are workstations where personnel work directly with plutonium or highly enriched uranium, and often it's very small amounts. We've also seen considerable amounts that appear safe on paper, and then when an updated inventory is done, they're nowhere to be found, leaving big question marks. Were they labeled as waste? Were they mistakenly disposed of? Were they shipped somewhere that they shouldn't have been? A million little mysteries exist in the muff world of military nuclear materials.
Yeah, and so let's talk about some of those mysteries. How much is out there in the wild, so to speak, versus still in the production process, like you said, in those glove boxes? Do we have any kind of data that would tell us which is the case and what the total universe of missing, unaccounted for material is?
It would be an absolute guess, and the reason is that when it comes to military nuclear materials, those that are suitable for building a nuclear weapon, such as highly enriched uranium or plutonium, basically there is no public accounting for this. On the civilian side of nuclear energy, you know, which is regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, almost the minute that something goes missing, there's an alert put up online, becomes part of a widely circulated annual report that comes out. On the military side of the house, we're really just guessing. One thing we can quantify is that as of almost a decade ago, when the last full accounting of missing nuclear material from the military side of the house was conducted by the Department of Energy's Inspector General, there were approximately 5 nuclear warheads worth of missing nuclear material. And these are attributable basically just to the national labs. These are what's lost in transport, what disappears in production, and these little dribs and drabs that we talked about getting caught in ducts and pipes and things like that. And also just flat-out lost material, things that are unaccounted for. How big are these? How little are they? It's really hard to say because it's such an opaque process.
But Patrick, you start off your article with a vignette about 2 DOE, I think, contractors who lost control of some nuclear material during, of all things, a car burglary. You want to tell us that story real quick?
Yeah, absolutely. And this really gets to the point of how seldom we see these things. There were 2 employees of a contractor that works for the Department of Energy. This is the company that runs Idaho National Laboratory. And their mission, specifically, they work for a unit that scoops up unwanted nuclear materials that have generally been on loan from the Department of Energy to research facilities, hospitals, universities. They were on their way to Texas, where this is a pretty common practice, to pick up nuclear material on loan to a research site that it has no use for anymore and wants to return to the Department of Energy. And the reason that we have a program like that here in the U.S. is with one purpose, just to make sure that all of this nuclear material, which could be used either in a bomb or a more crude sort of radiological dispersion device that we more commonly refer to as a dirty bomb, just to make sure that that material is accounted for and doesn't fall into unknown hands who might have nefarious intent. So these two folks went down to San Antonio to collect some specimens, and the night before they were due to pick those up, they spent the night at a hotel, and they had rented a vehicle. It was a sport utility vehicle. I believe it was a Ford Expedition. And in the back seat, they left two very conspicuous Pelican briefcases that were containing gauges meant to read radiation levels and verify that they were picking up the right materials. But along with those were a couple of samples, one of plutonium-239, the specific variety that's used in nuclear warheads, and one of cesium, which is most commonly used in nuclear medicine, blood irradiation, cancer treatment. And it is on a list from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of items that are known to be desired by terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So along with these gauges, someone broke into the back seat of this car, and they stole the gauges and the samples. So these samples are very small amounts. By themselves, they're relatively harmless. However, we don't know where they went, whether they've become part of a larger trove that someone is assembling or whether they were simply picked up by an opportunistic thief who didn't know what they had gotten their hands on.
And that raises another point, which is not all nuclear material is created equal, obviously. There's weapons-grade material, and there's more lowly enriched material that's used in medical applications, civilian power generation, etc. I think I know the answer to this question, but do we have any idea of this missing and unaccounted-for material, which categories we're talking about?
We don't. What we do know is that as of the 2009 report, the most recent accounting, and it's worth noting that there is no new accounting planned, according to the Department of Energy's Inspector General, but as of 2009, the five warheads worth that we discussed a little while ago, that is specifically plutonium-239 and highly enriched uranium, exactly what you need to make a nuclear bomb, not a crude dispersion device. This is what you need for a warhead. And there are five warheads worth of it minimum that were missing as of a decade ago.
You mentioned the kind of bifurcated oversight and regulatory process we have where civilian nuclear materials are overseen by the NRC and materials for defense use is handled by NNSA. Can you just talk a little bit more about some of the differences in how those two agencies carry out their oversight and accountability functions?
Sure, and it's a very important distinction, as a matter of fact, and it has led to some of the criticisms of really both, but especially the NNSA, which is the arm of the Department of Energy that oversees the nuclear weapons program. So let's start with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on the civilian side of things. If you've got a license to possess radioactive materials for a purpose such as nuclear medicine or oil and gas, natural resources exploration, or science, it would come from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Same for nuclear power. Anything that isn't military related falls under their purview. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is basically a fee-funded organization. Licensees create the budget for this oversight, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is sort of held up as a real standard for transparency. Their website, you know, almost anything you wanted to find out about the civilian side and whether operators are doing their job well, whether they're losing licenses, things of this nature, is very, very wide open and transparent because it's sort of the public interest side of the operation. When we get into the military uses of nuclear materials that are under the oversight of the Department of Energy and more specifically the NNSA, it's a sort of a black box in some ways, and that's because there's obviously nuclear secrets and national security at stake. But there are also some matters that arguably are more toward the point of hiding embarrassment, and these embarrassments often occur because of missteps taken by contractors. And there's wherein lies one of the big differences between NNSA and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The NNSA hires private firms to do the work that's research, development, and production of nuclear weapons. They are also responsible at NNSA for oversight. So they're wearing two hats, as it were. One is the whip cracking side, which is driving production and setting minimum quotas for work to be accomplished. They've got the sort of conflicting mission at NNSA of ensuring safety and security and making sure that things are done properly, which can slow down work. Work slowdowns tend to harm the bonuses that are paid to these companies, the weapon contractors. And so there's historically been a reluctance on the Department of Energy's part to, one, you know, slow down work that would interrupt progress towards the goals that they've established for their contractors. And two, you know, they want to spare embarrassment. And so we've seen, you know, not as thorough oversight at the Department of Energy as there is at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, at least in the eyes of many of the experts that we've spoken with.
One of the things that came up in the debate over this year's defense authorization bill around NNSA was, I think, the argument among some members of the Senate that at least one of the reasons why there are arguably accountability problems within NNSA is that it's buried deep within the Department of Energy. It's just one mission out of many within that department. And you could really improve things by just bringing it out from underneath the DOE umbrella and making it its own independent organization. And I just wonder if that sort of bureaucratic organization problem is something that rings true to you based on what you saw during the process of reporting this story.
I would say that there's a long line of problems at NNSA that would get in line ahead of that. If someone were to take, for instance, the oversight agency's reviews of NNSA, there are some frequent problems that keep popping up, and they have less to do with the bureaucracy at DOE, which has given NNSA sort of a you know, quasi-autonomous role where it's sort of its own independent agency within an agency. The bigger problem has been the conflict between the contractors and their overseers. You know, it's really a difficult mission. You talk to the folks who are on the production side at NNSA, and, you know, they're all about got to meet goals. You talk to the safety folks, and they're very careful that they don't want to slow down these goals, and it's come at the expense of safety at times. And I would say that probably the best example of that, or worst example of that, is at Los Alamos National Laboratory, where two specific events have really caused a massive setback, one on the weapons production side, one on the nuclear waste disposal side, and they both came in some ways from inattention to safety and too much attention on hurry, hurry, rush, rush. The first of those would be at what's called PF4 or Plutonium Facility 4 at Los Alamos. You know, since 2013, they have not produced a single usable, actually since 2011, a single usable plutonium pit. This is the trigger of a nuclear weapon. You know, there were safety concerns there, and they got so grave that the Department of Energy convinced the lab director in 2013 to temporarily pause operations at PF4. And that was a safety lapse that they still haven't really recovered from. Just earlier this year, NNSA had to designate a second site to meet its plutonium expectations for the immediate years ahead. And this was an issue of just, you know, not holding the contractor's feet to the fire on safety until things had eroded so dramatically that, as one NNSA official put it publicly in a forum where I asked him earlier this year, North Korea is better at building plutonium pits than the U.S. is, and this has been just contractors out of control. Los Alamos also, in its haste to meet, you know, a deadline imposed by New Mexico state regulators that DOE bought into, they got some bad waste down to the waste isolation pilot plant. This is the only repository for nuclear weapons waste in the U.S., and in Valentine's Day 2014, there was a drum from Los Alamos that burst and contaminated this repository. And for years, there were no deliveries of nuclear waste. It's backed up, you know, disposal of nuclear waste. It's led to waste being held in unauthorized and, frankly, unsafe places at a lot of the national labs where it's not intended. And these are just some examples of what can come from, you know, putting production so far ahead of safety that it actually undermines the very mission that these folks were created to do. And from my observations, those of the Government Accountability Office, those of the Inspector General, these are the types of things that are really forcing people to pull out their hair at NNSA.